Well, quite a program we have in store for you tonight with Jonathan Gray. Let me tell you about this story. Researcher Zachariah Sitchin says he's willing to stake everything he's written about alien astronauts and DNA tests that could be performed on a 4,500-year-old remains of a high Sumerian woman. It is the latest and possibly the last cause for him for this effort to get this word out. The way Sitchin sees it, the long-dead woman's genome could contain the signature of the gods, and he's been talking about this since 1976. But what does Jonathan Gray think about this? In a moment, we will talk with him about this in Dead Men's Secrets on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan Gray, international explorer, archaeologist, and author. He has traveled the world to gather data on ancient mysteries. And over the past 37-plus years, he has penetrated some largely unexplored areas. Now, in the course of these explorations, Jonathan began to uncover evidence of surprising out-of-place artifacts. According to what he was taught at school, this was impossible. They simply couldn't exist. And these were not just isolated anomalies. There was a global pattern to them, suggesting an ancient worldwide civilization of astonishing proportions. Here's Jonathan Gray. Jonathan, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, George. I'm very well, thank you.
I looked at the calendar when I knew you were scheduled. It's been about 3-plus years. Where have you been?
Well... Oh, I can't tell you all the places. It's been fun. It's good to be back in the land of the civilized again.
Absolutely. I want to talk with you a lot about ancient technology, but I had that Zechariah Sitchin story, so let's spend a little time this hour talking about that in your views. First of all, why don't you give us your overview of Zechariah and his theory, if you would?
Well, George, it's quite a long story now. In my very first book, Dead Men's Secrets, I was quoting Zechariah, and what has happened is this. Just to put the listeners in the picture, the theory is that a planet beyond Pluto called Planet Nibiru was dying. So its inhabitants, the Anunnaki, came to planet Earth, and they started mining for gold, which was needed to create a shield for preserving Nibiru's dwindling atmosphere. So you all actually start feeling sorry for these Anunnaki.
Yeah.
Anyway, they found the hot sun of planet Earth pretty hard to cope with, so they created primitive workers by mixing the genes of male Anunnaki with the eggs of early female hominoids to bring about you and me, Homo sapiens. And this sudden speed-up given to our evolution explains how the Sumerian civilization began suddenly, fully developed, with no evidence of a primitive beginning. So these extraterrestrials jump-started everything. Oh, and something else. The planet Nibiru, some people call this Planet X, brings it into our solar system in its orbit every 3,600 years, and it's due to come here very soon. That's basically the theory.
And the story came about by Zechariah's work with ancient Sumerian texts, right? His interpretation?
That is what he's telling us. That's very true, yes.
How did you...
Now,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, George.
How did you get involved in this particular issue?
Well, I guess... From my years of independent research, I knew that Mr. Sitchin had at least one thing correct. That paralleled my research, and that was the Sumerian civilization began suddenly, fully developed, with no evidence of a primitive beginning. And as you know, in today's world where we are taught that early man was primitive, it's quite a rare thing to hear about high technology in the ancient world. So I felt a measure of rapport with Mr. Sitchin. And so for this reason, my customary cautious approach softened toward this gentleman, and I did enjoy reading his books. They were full of entertainment, but good to read. So I suppose I let down my guard just a little bit to give the facts in the books due respect, in particular the claimed fact that certain ancient texts existed that backed up his story. I guess that's where I came on board.
Okay, with these ancient texts, Are you saying they don't exist or that he has interpreted them the wrong way?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I published him as an authority in the book Dead Men's Secrets and in another book, and I'll make it absolutely clear that what I'm about to say is not about the man, it's about the subject. I have no problem with Zechariah as a person. He's probably quite a nice guy. But for a number of years, I assumed that the story was, as he claimed, in the Sumerian records. Well, after all, you just don't make up things like that, do you? But then something happened. I began to receive emails from my newsletter list asking me about planet Nibiru, the Anunnaki, the Nephilim, the 3,600-year orbit of the planet. And so I felt an obligation to dig deeper so that I could give a responsible answer. Well, I was checking carefully through the story, and an irritating anomaly cropped up. Now, assuming the story was true, such a misfit piece would make no sense. It shouldn't exist. So that bothered me. So pursuing the matter, I went a little further, and then another inconsistency came up, then another and another. Boy, it was growing. Now, if you've endorsed something and found out that you have problems with it, you still have to look at yourself in the mirror the next day, right?
Yes.
And you have to give a responsible answer to readers that put your trust in you. Okay, I was excited about the claims. I quoted Mr. Sitchin in one of my key books. I came across discrepancies as I began to investigate further, and that threw me into a real in-depth investigation in those areas.
Yeah.
Now, for example, the claim that the Anunnaki came from planet Nibiru, the 12th planet. How do we know this is so? Well, according to our friend, it's in the Sumerian text. Problem. Search and search and search. But no matter how hard I might search, it was absolutely impossible to find even one such Sumerian text. Then there was Nibiru, a planet beyond Pluto. How do we know? According to our friend, the Sumerian texts tell us this. And again, I could not find one single Sumerian text that backed that up.
Did you ever contact him?
The fact that, pardon?
Did you ever contact him and say, hey, Zechariah,
yes,
where is this?
I was beginning to find all these problems, and so I did. I wrote to Mr. Sitchin, and I asked him if he could help me. In fact, I think I might have sent a copy of the letter to be put up on the internet if anyone wants to see it. But anyway, what I did was, there were so many pieces that didn't fit in my estimation that what could you do better than call the man himself? So I sat down and wrote to Zechariah asking him to help me. Surely he could make this clear. Well, about 2 months later, I got back a photocopy of my letter with Zechariah's few brief notes scribbled over it. Now, my first question was this. I said, Zechariah, I notice you translate Nephilim as people of the fiery rockets and also those who came down from heaven. Would you kindly explain how this was arrived at using the rules of the Hebrew morphology, and where do you get the understanding that this has to do with fire or rockets? In which ancient text does this come from? The reply was this. People of fiery rockets is the Din and the Gur and the Anunnaki, those who came down from heaven. That's all he said. What ancient text, however? Then I'd also asked, what Sumerian text says that Anunnaki came from the planet Nibiru? The answer was, Jonathan, haven't you read my books? Well, yes, I had, but there was nothing in there. Where's the ancient text that says these things? My question number three was, why do many of your important word meanings or translations of Sumerian words differ so much from the Sumerian cuneiform bilingual dictionaries? Well, he sounded surprised that I was asking these questions, but the dear man had thrown down the challenge, so I had to go on my own I couldn't expect any further help, so I went digging again. Now, I consider this to be important for a couple of reasons, George. Millions of well-meaning people had taken this theory on board.
Sure, including me, Jonathan.
Even whole world view is based upon this for millions of people, I suppose. And secondly, I was responsible for having quoted this dear man as a source, and I had cited Sitchin as a knowledgeable authority concerning the Sumerians. I guess there were two things at stake. First of all, Mr. Sitchin's space visitors theory stands or falls on the Sumerian texts, whether they exist or not.
Right.
And that now affects millions of people. And secondly, the integrity of the ancient cuneiform tablets is now at stake because it disagrees with Mr. Sitchin's definitions. So if he's right, then the bilingual Sumerian dictionaries compiled by the Mesopotamian scribes are wrong.
Well, as you know, Jonathan, Michael Heiser also would agree with you.
Oh, yes. Well, I guess the challenge is to produce the texts that I say don't exist, and secondly, produce verification of the translations by other experts. Because, you know, the interesting thing is that the Sumerian dictionaries exist, and perhaps it was not known that such dictionaries were in existence. Certainly they were not available on the Internet or anywhere until recently, and perhaps it was thought that they'd never be available, but here we are. We've got these dictionaries, and they don't agree at all. They agree among themselves, but not with Mr. Sitchin's theory.
Has anyone else, Jonathan, tried to interpret these Sumerian texts? You know, Zechariah apparently is an expert in being able to decipher them. Has anybody else been able to look at them?
Yes, actually. The University of Chicago's Oriental Institute has put out the lexical lists from the Sumerians themselves. A scholar called Benno Landsberger actually started this off. He's a great Sumerian scholar. And in the Journal of Near Eastern Studies produced by the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute, these are now available to us. Also, what we have is the University of California at Berkeley. They've put up on a website now digital corpus of cuneiform literature, and you just click on the cuneiform tablet and it'll take you to the explanation of all the words. And also the University of Pennsylvania have a Sumerian dictionary. Now, all of these lexicons and dictionaries agree with each other because they are actually written by the Sumerian scribes themselves 4,000 years ago.
But you are not saying, Jonathan, that something unusual has not happened on this planet. We'll get into that as we discuss this with you, especially some of this high technology. You just don't agree specifically that we were visited, that there was a planet out there like that. Am I correct?
What I'm correct is saying that there's no Sumerian text that backs up the theory. It came out of our dear friend's head. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Okay. Now, let's move on just a little bit into this ancient technology, this lost technology. Tell me what you think was lost, and when did this happen?
Well, I guess a whole lot of things were lost, George. What we have is an advanced technology in the past that was worldwide. I happened to be writing a history book a few years ago, and I was following the traditional line that we were all, of course, taught at school, and I wanted to bring out new facts to enlighten that, but I started digging a little bit deeper, and I came across things that surprised me. For example, we were taught that man was very, very primitive in the past, and that Stone Age man couldn't put anything together except perhaps a club and his wife's hair to pull her along, you know what I mean? But it became very evident that as far back as archaeology goes, man was very sophisticated, and that the nation of Egypt, as well as Sumeria and the Indus Valley, all popped up, as it were, out of nowhere, fully formed, fully developed, at the top, not at the bottom. and that rather than increasing in technology, they were actually decreasing as time went on, because the lowest levels of discovery, the lowest or oldest levels of excavation, show that the first substance for Egypt and those other countries was actually sophisticated more than those that followed it.
So we
started at the top.
We regressed, didn't we?
We regressed. That's right. We devolved. We regressed.
How is our civilization as a whole on this planet, is it much older than we thought?
No, it's not actually. As far back as archaeology goes, we come into the third millennium BC, as far as evidence goes. Anything beyond that is hypothetical or, shall I say, speculative.
Okay. If this technology was so advanced and then we kind of regressed, how did it get so high from the get-go?
Well, the fact that Egypt and Sumeria and the Indus Valley and the Maya all sprang up suddenly round about the same time did get me wondering, actually. So I went researching and found that they had so many things in common that led back in a pattern to the Middle East. So something started in the Middle East that gave impetus to these sudden ready-made civilizations. And I remember a Russian scientist saying, well, what was this impetus? Could it have been a Mother X civilization that was wiped out, and then the survivors or their descendants started off again with a very high knowledge, and all they needed was a population large enough in each case to produce a culture where you could put into practice that knowledge that you already had bequeathed to you?
Would that be Atlantis?
Well, Atlantis is one name to give it. Many people also give it the antediluvian name, pre-flood world. And whatever we want to call it, there certainly must have been a high civilization prior to this great disaster.
Jonathan, this theory of this high technology will tell you, and let me cite this example. From 1900 to 2000, 100 years, merely just 100 years, we had one of the most advanced technologies modern man has ever had, in just 100 years. So you can only imagine if they had some kind of technology back hundreds of thousands of years ago, perhaps, what 5,000 years would have done to that. I mean, look what happened us with just 100 years. 5,000 years of technology, they could have just exploded.
Oh, they could have. They could have gone to the moon, Mars, and so on. I believe perhaps they did.
Well, there's been a theory on that. That's very possible. So what you believe is that these were Earthlings who developed incredible technology. We'll get into that. But we did not have extraterrestrial help.
I don't believe we needed extraterrestrial help. I do believe that we have evidence that everything we have here in the past that archaeology is discovering fits in with man's own thinking capabilities, and that we did have ancestors who were pretty smart.
Well, stay with us. Jonathan Gray is our special guest tonight. His website, beforeus.com, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Jonathan is way down under in Australia. It's amazing how far technology has gone, even for us, isn't it? I'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We're with Jonathan Gray tonight. Jonathan, let's talk about some of the evidence that exists out there about some of these high-tech ancient civilizations. What were you able to find? Jonathan? Well, there is no Jonathan, but we will have to find him sooner than later. You know, he's down in Australia, and let me tell you something. That's a long, long way. So we'll try to call him back, and we'll get him on and continue this interview, because it is fascinating. He does not agree with the work of Zachariah Sitchin at all, at all. But he does believe that there were ancient high-tech civilizations. So this is going to be a long-distance call all the way to Australia. So we'll try to hook in, and hopefully he's back there. Jonathan, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Where'd you go?
The phone went off. It suddenly went engaged.
Okay. My question was, give us some of the evidence of some of this high technology of the past.
Oh, I'd be very pleased to. There have been found in some of the ancient graves in Egypt a kind of glassware that can be bent like plastic. Over in Peru, something similar has been found. And in the Roman Empire, there was discussion on drinking glasses and other items which could be bent and yet not break. What we're looking at here probably is some type of plastic technology similar to what we use today. It looks like glass, but is not glass.
What else is out there?
Well, screen projectors were used in Egypt. Screen projectors were used in some of the temples. What they did was they had movable projectors that could be advanced on wheels toward a big screen, and it would make the appearance of a person on the picture rushing at the audience or moving away from the audience. And sound was also produced, which would give the simulation of the person on the screen speaking. Now, we don't know exactly how they went about this, but we do have ancient records describing the phenomenon and how the worshippers in the temple were easily overcome by emotion to do the bidding of the priests with such technology, which was in the hands of the priests but not in the knowledge of the people as technology.
Did you ever come across anything which would give you reason to say that the Egyptians built the pyramids, but they had high technology to do so?
Yes, I do believe so. There are ancient legends handed down by the ancient Egyptians stating that they used the power waves for sound, that heavy weights were lifted in the quarries by sound waves, and that they were placed into position in the great buildings by a similar method.
If it was placed in the quarry by similar methods.
In other words, sound waves were used, certainly not pulleys and ramps, which would have to be bigger than the pyramids themselves.
Absolutely.
As far as bulk goes.
Where did all the technology go, Jonathan? Where is it?
Now, if today there was a huge disaster, George, and America was almost wiped off the map, and some of the advanced countries, Japan, Germany, and so on, the lesser civilized countries would eventually resort to a second rate of civilization, and their civilization might even well go down. There is evidence that around about 2000 BC, in Asia and in the Middle East and in South America, and yes, possibly in the Death Valley region of North America, there was a huge disaster which left radiation burns from above and melted the brickworks. In other words, we're looking at something that makes one think of perhaps atomic energy. And there are reports in documents which have been preserved in India speaking of a city that was given 7 days for its inhabitants to get out because a rocket was coming to destroy the city, just one hit, and the whole city would be destroyed. Now, in the area, the geographical area described in the old documents, today there is radioactivity found and melted brickwork. So it looks like this was not just fiction being written. There was something to do with fact.
Was there any technology beyond the Egyptians, way before them?
The technology that we have springing up around about the same time for the three or four civilizations has many points in common, suggesting that these civilizations, Egypt, the Indus Valley, Sumeria, the Maya, did not rise independently, but their impetus came from the same source because there are patterns of similarity which coincidence would not produce. And I'm speculating here. I don't think we have to speculate too much to get to it, that this great disaster that wiped out the previous mother civilization had survivors, and these survivors, once they produced enough population, were able to get these new civilizations springing up again. We're looking at what I would call the pre-flood world. 600 legends worldwide speak of this disaster as the Great Flood, a cosmic disaster.
Jonathan, this ancient technology you believe is being suppressed. By whom and why?
Technology is being suppressed, definitely, and discoveries of some of these things are being swept under the carpet or even dumped in the Caribbean Sea. We have a record of a ship going out and dumping a whole lot of artifacts that didn't fit with the agenda. And one of the most prestigious institutions in the world, I don't think I ought to name it, was responsible for this one, according to the reports.
Name it. Go ahead.
Smithsonian Institution.
No. Unbelievable. Why would they? But why? What's the motive?
Well, the Smithsonian Institute was very honorably started by men who wanted to increase and disperse knowledge. But later on, the committee in charge of it became weighted with people who had a different agenda, and that was, firstly, to show that America did not have visitors before Columbus, and secondly, to help improve the public status of the evolution theory. And anything that went against both those theories was to be dumped or hidden away or destroyed.
Even if you're an evolutionist, the belief of an ancient civilization that possessed high technology should not crush that theory, should it?
Well, it goes against the idea that we are improving. It rather suggests that we did have something big at the start. We were intelligent at the beginning, and we didn't have to evolve that intelligence. As far as evolution goes, it had to be evolved slowly over a period of time, and the earliest civilization should be the most primitive.
Well, what if
archaeology is coming against that?
What if we were improving, but something happened? Maybe an asteroid hit us, or some kind of earth-shattering calamity that wiped out civilizations, and we had to start over again, as we may have to now.
Well, things aren't looking very good now, are they, George?
Mm-mm, not really.
I know. We're a bit worried about it even on this side of the world. Anyway, the evolution system does not allow for such matters at all. Evolution is a slow, uninterrupted progress, and anything like that even smells of a worldwide disaster is anathema. You're not just not allowed to put it into the theory.
Now, the dumping that you said was happening from ships into the ocean, into the sea, what kind of technology, what kind of artifacts do you think they were getting rid of?
I can only speculate, George, but it included artifacts and also giant human remains, remains of very big people.
As the Bible talked about, basically.
Exactly.
The Nephilim?
Yes, they were giants. And this is something that, of course, is also not very popular. Bible history and evolutionary theory have many things which are antagonistic toward each other, and it seems that never the twain will meet. And the evolutionary establishment, I'm sorry to say, is not looking at the Bible as good history, and they're missing out on something that they could really benefit from.
Tell me this incredible story in China about the opening of a coffin. You've talked about that in some of your work.
Yes, that's true. Archaeologists actually were digging into some of the old Chinese cemeteries, and they came across a tomb, and when they opened it, they saw these seeds that were put into a little box on the chest of the mummy. And by the way, there were mummies there too. They weren't just buried. They were mummified, just like the Egyptians,
sure,
which seems to have been quite a worldwide practice, George. And they pushed they pushed this little box of seeds aside, and a lot of them just spilled on the ground in the room there. And after several days of working there in that big tomb, they suddenly noticed that the seeds were starting to sprout. And it turned out that these were tomato plants that had been buried for more than 2,000 years in a Chinese tomb. Now, what's the significance of that? It simply shows that there was worldwide trade. China, on one side of the Pacific, was trading with people from South America because the tomato is a native of South America. It doesn't grow naturally in China.
That's a good point.
So here we have unknown voyages coming up.
You talk about heart transplant operations in ancient China.
In ancient China, in Egypt, and also in South America now. So it's becoming a worldwide pattern again. This is what I like about archaeology. If you go looking for patterns, you will find them because they do exist. And it suggests that there was a worldwide knowledge of these things and not just an isolated development.
Where would you say we are now, today, technologically speaking, compared to what they had then? Are we about matched with them now? Are we ahead of them? Where are we?
Perhaps in some ways we are ahead of them, but I've been able to isolate at least 64 ways in which we are not yet, not up there yet. They were still ahead of us, even in our 21st century, which we think is pretty good.
We talked about going to the moon, that the ancients may have gone. Do you think they left artifacts on the moon and perhaps our astronauts saw these?
Oh, yes, I do. When the first walk by Neil Armstrong, I know that some people have tried to rubbish this and say it didn't happen, but I heard the broadcast. I was walking up Hay Street, Perth, in Western Australia at the time when Neil Armstrong was supposed to be on the moon. And was it Buzz Aldrin or was it somebody else was in the capsule that was orbiting? I'm not quite sure.
The one that was orbiting was Michael Collins. Buzz was down there.
Michael
on the moon.
Collins. Yeah. Okay. Michael Collins. He gave a report and he looked down and he said, "That appears to be a man-made structure," and he described it. In fact, he spent 11 minutes describing what he was seeing. Now, millions of people heard that broadcast, and I heard it also. But in the replays of that initially live broadcast, that 11 minutes was cut out. Now, we do have Chinese records which, interestingly, speak of Chinese going to the moon. And I should preface this by saying that in China it was illegal, it was forbidden to write fiction. There was a law passed by one of the early emperors that if anyone wrote fiction, he was to lose his head.
Why?
And so writers were very careful only to write fact.
Why?
Oh, I don't know why. I guess, you know, some people don't like fiction. Others like truth. And this man happened to be one of those.
The suppression, if that's what's going on, to me,
yes,
is truly remarkable that they just don't want us to know that the ancients possessed this kind of knowledge and technology. Do you know Michael Cremo at all, Jonathan?
Yes, I know his work. He's done a wonderful work looking into anomalies in coal mines and so on.
Yeah, he believes that civilizations were millions of years older than they are today. And if that's the case, they probably did have ancient technology, even though you say it started sooner.
Yeah, I believe it's less than that. But never mind what he's found. He's found some very good stuff, and it's a matter of interpretation of time. I was going to mention that the Chinese records speak not only of astronauts going to the moon, but they actually describe the moon as it would appear, and it described the Earth as it would appear from the moon. All this is down in the Chinese records.
Tell me about
that. When Richard Nixon went across and they had a cultural exchange with the Chinese, a lot of these writings were translated into English. So we now have them available. And they mention a building they constructed on the moon, which they called the Palace of Cold, because the temperature was so cold on the moon. And they speak also of the glassy appearance of the surface of the moon.
As they're just starting to talk about now.
Yes.
Amazing. What else did they say?
There was a time when this had to cease. Another emperor called a halt to the space program of China. This was back about 2,300 years ago. He called a halt to the space visits because he said that there were more important things to do at home. And therefore, any scientific exploits to the moon or other places were discontinued.
Jonathan, what kind of propulsion system do you think they had?
I believe, George, that there were several methods of propulsion. One used mercury. Mercury was considered to have such a power in it that it could lift rockets off the surface of the Earth. And I notice now that in modern times, the French scientific community has been talking about using mercury for a similar purpose. There was found in the ruins of a city in southern Russia some years ago the remains of an ancient scientific complex, and there were little bottles of mercury. Now, whatever they were doing with the mercury, we don't know, but we can speculate perhaps that they had ways of using it for propulsion. We certainly know they speak about using it for propulsion, but we haven't any physical evidence other than these little bottles.
What do you think happened, Jonathan, to all these people who had this technology? Some Earth-wide calamity?
This technology would have been around about 2000 to 1000 BC, and we do know that certain civilizations did wipe each other out, and possibly that would be the cause. However, in South America, earthquakes and volcanism wiped out whole cities, very advanced cities, and some of their descendants who live in the jungles today, and that happened to be my first expedition into the jungles of eastern Ecuador in the Amazon. These people who now live in a Stone Age existence speak of their ancestors as having lived in great shining cities where the lights never went out at night. So there's an example of what we call savages, who did not have a savage beginning. They haven't evolved. They're not just evolving upwards. They've come down from a civilized society that was wiped out.
Do you think this planet has been visited by extraterrestrials at all? Let's just not even get into the Zechariah Sitchin theory.
That's a very interesting question. Now, of course, if we go to the Bible speaks of angelic beings
right.
coming from the Creator to Earth. And in that sense, I would say most definitely, yes. But if we take the scientific approach of astronauts coming from other worlds to this planet, I think we have to start asking ourselves a few questions here. Perhaps I could refer to Alan Hynek,
Jonathan, we're going to take this break. We're at the top of the hour. You just hang on the phone there, and we'll be right back. Jonathan, the ancient texts of India talk about nuclear war between two nations, between groups. Something could have happened a long time ago. Did you discover anything like that?
Yes, up in the ruins of Mohenjo-Daro in the Indus Valley, there's great radioactivity still. George, there have been found skeletons up there of people who are still radioactive.
So something
across in the Ganges area, up in the northeast area of India, there are also ruins which show they have been melted from above. An English explorer about 150 years ago was up in that way when Britain actually was ruling over India, and he fell into a hole. He was walking and his foot fell down into a hole, so he opened the hole up a bit more and he slipped himself down into a room which was under the ground. And he noticed that everything appeared to be as glass. And interestingly, there was something sitting on a chair. It looked like a statue. And surely it couldn't be a human being. It was like glass. But as he looked closer, he realized this was a vitrified human being. Now, how this can happen, we don't know. But it shows that something very unusual had taken place and destroyed this city.
Well, and the fact that ancient texts would attest to something like that, too, would back that up.
Yes, the ancient text and the physical remains coincide pretty closely. The ancient text also said that the hair fell out, that you could decontaminate yourself by going into water. We know that this is a practice used today when radiation is involved.
What do we know of Stonehenge and other things like the Great Pyramid?
Well, Stonehenge and the Great Pyramid, I do believe, were constructed in order to help remapping of the world. Let me put it this way. They were astronomically placed, and they also were only part of a worldwide network of pyramids and standing stones. We can trace these all over the world. These are the two of the most famous, of course. Now, we do know that there was a change in the length of the year after the great disaster, that the original year was 360 days and that the new calendar became 365 and a quarter days. And we know by measurements in the Great Pyramid that this represents measurements based upon a 365 and a quarter day year. So the Great Pyramid was built after the great disaster, not before it. A Stonehenge gives us similar measurements, but both of them are orientated for the purpose of tracking and predicting movements of the heavenly bodies. So we believe that they were part of a worldwide system that was built, and this system actually left behind several maps actually based upon Cairo in Egypt as the center. And these maps showed longitude and latitude. So there was a huge mapping survey that took place for a period after the great disaster. I like to call it the Great Flood because most people do. And these new civilizations that sprang up had to remap the world and recalculate the eclipses, recalculate the positions of the Earth in relation to the heavenly bodies and its new orbit around the sun, because it looks like the orbit had changed somewhat, hence the length of the day, the length of the year being altered.
Right,
but the old calendars did have 360 days to a year. The new calendars, based upon the Great Pyramid, of which the Great Pyramid actually is a memorial, and also Stonehenge, show a 365 and a quarter day year. So I believe this was involved in the mapping process of the world to reassess where everything was after the great disaster.
Jonathan, right before the break, we were talking about the great late J. Allen Hynek.
Oh, yes, yes. We're talking about the aliens or the UFO phenomenon, weren't we?
Yes.
J. Allen Hynek was a scientific consultant with the U.S. Air Force on Project Blue Book, and he also founded the Center for UFO Studies, along with the UFO researcher Jacques Vallée. And these men, in all of their consultation with people who were experiencing, shall we say, contact with UFO phenomena, noticed that there were paranormal aspects. Certainly there were physical aspects, but also paranormal ones. And Hynek eventually came out with a statement that the extraterrestrial theory runs up against a very big difficulty. And that is that we are seeing too many UFOs. After all, the Earth is only a spot of dust in the universe. Why should it be honored with so many visits? And when he was asked for his hypothesis, he said, I'm more inclined to think in terms of something metaterrestrial, a sort of parallel reality. And he then concluded, he said, UFOs may be a psychic phenomenon, and the aliens may not come from outer space, but from a parallel reality. I thought that was a rather interesting observation.
There are many that are beginning to think that. I still would love to believe that they're coming from planetary systems within our galaxy, in our universe. But you know what? Maybe they are coming from parallel dimensions.
Yes, it's rather interesting when you consider a few facts. In all the millions of sightings, there has never been even one radar detection. And I'm quoting here a UFO researcher, John Weldon, there's never been one radar detection of a UFO entering our atmosphere from outer space. There's plenty of radar once they're in the atmosphere, but the actual entering from outer space has never been radar tracked. Also, the shall we call them ETs, appear quite able to breathe in our atmosphere without respiratory equipment. And another thing, although fired upon many times by Russian and Canadian and American pilots, never has a UFO been brought down, a UFO in real plain sight. And it's interesting also that no UFOs seen at different times ever look exactly alike. Now, that would suggest that they're here, emanating, it seems, from our own planet Earth, and although visible, they may not be physical entities. They appear not to be bound by the same material physical laws as we are. And studying the question, it's interesting that if UFOs are only tangible hardware, how is it that they can change shape before our eyes? They can vanish like a Cheshire cat, now I'm not even leaving a grin, and seemingly melt away in front of us, materializing, dematerializing. It does suggest another dimension. And there's something else too, where two distinctly different UFOs can hover in a clear sky and converge and eventually merge into the same one object. How can we explain that if they're purely physical?
Tell me a little bit about what you discovered about what you've called the Black Knight satellite. What is that?
Oh, that's a very interesting one.
Jonathan, everything you've said tonight is interesting.
Thank you, George. Well, certainly I'm devoting my life to this because I love it. I certainly do find it interesting. Well, the Black Knight... when I wrote Dead Men's Secrets, my first edition of Dead Men's Secrets was way back in 1988, I think it was. But a lot of new information's come in, of course, since then. Way back in 1953, 4 years before the USSR launched Sputnik 1, the Black Knight was sighted by a doctor at La Paz in Bolivia. And then other sightings of this unusual object began to be reported. Then no more was heard for about 4 years. Now, when they started tracking the orbits of the United States satellite that was put up and the Soviet satellite, they discovered officially this huge satellite and went into the official records. Astronomers and military tracking stations followed its course, and they found it was in a polar orbit. Now, the satellites put up by the Russians and the Americans were not in a polar orbit. This one was in a polar orbit, but the startling thing was that compared to the U.S. satellite, which weighed, I think it was 450 pounds thereabouts, and the Soviet one just under 3,000 pounds in weight.
Always heavier, yeah.
Yeah, this one weighed 15 tons.
Wow.
It was a giant.
Who got it up there? We did? A long time ago?
Well, ancient records of the ancient races do talk about putting up satellites. It's rather interesting, and even the orbits of satellites and what the Earth looks like from them. So I guess we are not the first.
Truly remarkable stuff, Jonathan. Can you imagine that?
And they it's hard to imagine, I know, but it's a well-recorded fact now. And I was asking a friend who has pretty privileged access to sources that know a lot more about it than you and I do concerning the Black Knight. And this person said to him, well, how do you know about that? It's highly classified. You're not supposed to be talking about this. But he got two of the three dimensions of it. One dimension was 10 feet, the other was 70 feet. He hasn't got the third one, so it's pretty big.
What do you think of, have you ever seen that picture from Abydos in Egypt? It's like a tablet, and it looks like a helicopter, a submarine, a ship. It's incredible.
Yes, I know the one you mean.
Yep.
It certainly is. And if we didn't know where it came from, we would say this is a drawing by some high school student who's drawing a real helicopter and a real submarine of our day.
Exactly. I mean, so they either had knowledge of ancient technology, or they had it, Or, you know, I'm not going to rule out visitation with technology. I don't think we can do that yet. Do you?
Okay, let's not rule it out. But my position would be that the odds would be against it because we don't need to explain what we've got. Look, in the last 100 years, as you were saying too, George, what we've got has been done by ourselves, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
We've got pretty clever brains. Was it Einstein that says we're only using 10% of our brain power or something? Just imagine if we were using 100% of it.
The Vermanas in India talked about they were ancient ships, weren't they?
They were, yes. In fact, there's one book that's been written from those ancient Indians, and that tells not only how to build aircraft, not only how to fly them, not only how to avoid crashing into other flying craft, but also how to hear conversations in enemy planes. Goodness me, what kind of surveillance techniques did they know about?
You know, Jonathan, let's move over to the Americas for a moment and look at some of the ancient work that's being done here. What were some of the strange things that have happened in the Americas that you were able to find?
Strange in technology or strange in cover-ups?
Technology.
Technology. Well, in America, yes. Perhaps I should quote a friend of mine who's on my email list and who writes to me from time to time, and he reported something that occurred in 1971. And he said that he was part of an archaeology team from a college in California, and a man in Southern California had discovered a capstone of a sort, which was about 15 inches covered in soil on his property. And it was 6 feet long by 4 feet wide and weighed about 1,900 pounds. It was pretty heavy, but he was convinced there was an empty void beneath the stone. So he called the college, and they sent out four other guys and he together to check it out. And when they got there, they came to the conclusion it might be an ancient burial site. So they arranged for an archaeology team to come out, lift the stone and check out the site. Well, 3 days later, they had the stone moved and they entered a man-made underground complex of four rooms. The total area was about 35 by 40 by 50 feet, with stone walls and beams and ceiling and floor, and even sophisticated rain drainage grooves cut in, which led to an underground stream. Now, inside each of the rooms were metallic sheets, which later turned out to be a variation of aluminium, or as you call it, aluminium, isn't it?
Aluminium.
Yeah. Now, this was very ancient, and each of these aluminium sheets had diagrams of flying craft on it. This is right here in North America,
oh,
California.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. And detailed star charts, designs for buildings, pictures of various surgeries being performed. And the language on the sheets looked familiar, but nobody was able to decipher it. The best guess was that it was a very old language that existed in the time of ancient Egypt, perhaps.
See, I find that to be exciting, don't you?
Oh, really do, yes. And then they found skeletal remains, including skulls. And the people there, the bodies there were about 9 feet in height. There were three of them. And they also found down there what appeared to be clear plastic cubes. And the most amazing thing that stuck in his mind was when you exposed them to fire, they got icy cold. And when you placed them in ice water, they'd get very hot. Now, how can you explain that? Anyone got any ideas about that?
No. You're talking Russia that they found some microtechnology deep underground, right?
Yes, they did. Yeah. Okay. But let me tell you something about what happened to this find in America. Do you know what? One of the team contacted the local police, George, and asked if they could guard the site. Well, the very next day, two U.S. Army officers, a major and a captain, arrived with 8 Army troops, and they seized the land.
Yeah, this was their site, right?
Yeah, that's right. And within days, the property was gutted and filled with fresh soil. And overnight, someone broke into the archaeological office and stole all the pictures and artifacts they'd collected. And when my friend William challenged the army officers about what they were doing, the major just looked straight in his face and says, "It'd be a shame to have to kill you right here and there. Can you believe that happening in America?"
Dead serious, too.
Yeah, he was. Now, nobody can tell me that the government's not covering up the fact that thousands of years ago there was an advanced people living in America, even.
One of the great finds in Iraq that has not been suppressed was the ancient battery. You've heard of that one, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. That's a wonderful find.
And, you know, they probably thought it was used for plating and everything else, but the fact is it was ancient and they had it.
Yep. It was real, all right. And there have been some others found just like it up in the same area. I think there was up in the north part of Iraq, there was the remains of an old city, and what appeared to be an assembly line for batteries was dug up. The city was destroyed suddenly.
Let's get into this Russian discovery.
Okay. About the microtechnology. Up there in the Ural Mountains, gold prospectors are still finding some of these. They're spiral-shaped. They're made from copper and tungsten and molybdenum. Now, today, tungsten's used for hardening special steels and also for the filaments of light bulbs. Molybdenum is used for hardening steel and giving anti-corrosion properties to tools. But, George, just get this. The size of these artifacts range from 1.2 inches, about 3 centimeters, down to an incredible 1,000th of an inch.
They're nanos, aren't they?
Nanos, yes. And exact measurements have been made using electron microscopes. And these artifacts are constructed according to the phi ratio, or what you might call the golden section, the phi proportion.
So much to talk with you about when we come back. I've got to ask you about this jet plane that they may have found in the tomb of Tut. That's next. Jonathan, I got a text in from John in Cleveland, wants to know if the Tower of Babel was a star observatory or a launch tower rocket site.
The Tower of Babel actually was a communication center for a presumed and planned world government. Its religious aspect was the worship of the stars. It was about 300 feet high, but was not a rocket terminal.
It was not. Okay. Now back to this Russian technology. So they found nano machines, basically.
Well, that's what we might call it. Yes, that's right. And these have been examined very carefully in four different universities, one in Finland and three in Russia. Definitely very sophisticated. Reminds us of our nanotechnology. And we don't know how what they used it for, but here we have it. No question.
Of everything that you've worked on over the years, and you've been doing this as an archaeologist and explorer for more than 30-plus years, what one aspect has fascinated you, Jonathan, here?
Well, I suppose one of the greatest secrets of archaeology is underground tunnels. And this has always fascinated me. Even since a kid, I've loved exploring old gold mining tunnels and things. But here we have reports coming from all over the world. I've been down to three of them myself. My wife's been down to one of them with me. Some very sophisticated people lived in them. They got married. They died in them. They have air conditioning. They had good water supply. Well, they went to school in them. In one of them in Turkey, there's remains of a huge dome underground that could hold 60,000 people probably for some sports events. That's mind-blowing to me. That's what I enjoy
It truly is. Let's talk about some of the ancient flight that might have been happening. Not going to the moon, but just flying around this planet. What do they have?
Well, a clue comes from Egypt to start with. Some models were found in tombs, which, because archaeologists couldn't even think of ancient flight being possible, they called these bird symbols. Well, they had all the aspects of aeronautics except the way birds are shaped, but they're shaped more like aeroplanes of today because aerodynamics doesn't change a lot. Now, in the tomb of Tutankhamun, a researcher discovered drawings which had just been passed off as unexplainable, but this man had an aeronautic mind, and he copied down the drawings and he photographed them, went back to Britain, and the British Aeronautical Society said, let's give it a try. So they built a model from this, and it flew. And the last I heard was they were trying to raise money to do a life-size one.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Did they have computers then?
Well, we don't know about Egypt in particular, but we do know that computers did exist, not the type of computers we had, although, who knows, if we've got nanotechnology being found, what it was used for. But on a shipwreck off the Aegean coast of Greece, a shipwreck which dated 55 BC, a lot of things from its cargo were brought up, and among them was one object which was encrusted from the sea, and rather than spoil it, they just put it, trying to get off the encrustation. They didn't have the technology or the way to do it. They just left it on the shelf for 50 years until a gentleman came in and says, I know how to get this cleaned up. When he did, he discovered it was an object about the size of a portable computer, laptop computer, and it had scores of gear wheels interlocking. It had a dial. You could set a question, and it would roll around an answer and tell you where you were in longitude and latitude, and it would predict backwards and forwards the positions of all the heavenly bodies used in navigation. And this was on a ship, 55 BC, but because of its sophistication, we believe it must have come from an earlier time, probably 1,000 or so years earlier, and that would take us right back to the height of Egypt's glory. So maybe the Egyptians did have something like that.
Maybe
so. Speculate. But of course, we have the Library of Alexandria, which had 1 million volumes, giving us insight into the technology of the ancient world. And what a pity that was destroyed. How much different our history would be if we had all that in front of us.
It also tells me, though, Jonathan, that this has been, continues to be, a killing planet. No matter how sophisticated they get, no matter how the technology grows, mankind is going to destroy each other.
And George, you've raised a point there. The more sophisticated the technology, the more demonic the destruction.
Yes, that's true, and we're seeing that all the time. Where does your research take you next? What do you do?
Well, I've been investigating a lot of cover-ups. More recently, I could talk about that one for hours. Cover-ups in America, in Israel, in Peru, in New Zealand, in Australia, in France, just name it. They're going on all over the place. Cover-ups of archaeological discoveries.
What's the motive?
The motive, I do believe, is to preserve reputations. And people who have been teaching something for years, teaching a theory for years, something is found that proves it wrong. What are they going to do? Well, they have to. First of all, they have to go along with the popular line for their own job's sake. Secondly, if they support it, they are in danger of losing grants for their research. And thirdly, they have their reputations to protect if they've been saying something the opposite. And so discoveries pose a threat to reputations, grants, and salaries.
Hmm. Well, we've seen that happen with just about everything, don't we?
In all fields. I mean, it's not just in science. It's on just about every field you want to name.
Tell me about some of these 14 maps of the ancient world that you say basically disappeared.
A couple of these are very well known, and perhaps I might have even mentioned them before. The Piri Reis map is perhaps the most famous one, but It's a great map. It really is a good map. It was part of a world map. It was drawn in the late Middle Ages, but the author said that he got the information from ancient maps thousands of years older. And several of the medieval map makers said the same thing. because they were drawing maps of places that were at that time not even known. For example, back in the 1700s, Antarctica was not known, yet it was on these old maps. And interestingly, Antarctica was on several maps in different stages of its history. One map of Antarctica showed that it was it had been so well mapped, rivers, mountains, and even settlements could be picked out. In other words, it was inhabited. Then that was before the ice came over. And then another map shows the ice creeping over the continent. And then a later map shows the ice as it is today.
Is this something that they could only have seen from above?
Yes, it's the kind of accuracy that today we could only get from satellite or flight photography.
You know, outside of that satellite that you say is up there, the Black Knight one, the ancient one, would it not be incredible if, with our discoveries, that we would see these other satellites that may still be up there?
It's possible, yes.
Thousands of years ago? I wonder if they're still functional.
I'd love to be an astronaut to take an out. I'd love to explore inside one of those, George. Wouldn't you like to come?
Absolutely. Absolutely. How far did we go? Did we go to Mars?
It's possible we did go to Mars because Russian surveillance of Mars has picked out what appears to be the remains of a city with streets shaped out from the center like spokes going out in different directions. The Russians were convinced that this is a city from the past, and I believe perhaps that we may have done it because we did have the technology back then.
Michael Cremo says that there was a discovery of these metal balls, these spheres, that look man-made. Have you heard of that story?
Yes, yes, and he's probably right about that.
And they just can't figure out what would shape it. There's just no way, I don't think, that these things could be formed naturally.
No, they do appear to be man-made. In fact, they're just as much man-made as I believe a square box would be. You don't get certain things in nature so easily.
Is there anything criminal to the dumping of these artifacts, the withholding of the information?
Well, you know, if I was an archaeologist who had spent a few years collecting things like this because they were so precious, or if you were, George, wouldn't you be so mad about them going and dumping your stuff so the world couldn't see it?
I'd be furious. Now, are any of them whistleblowers? Do they come forward and say, this is what's going on?
Yes, we do get whistleblowers who can't look at themselves in the mirror the next day and they get worried about it until eventually they crack and tell somebody. They don't usually come out publicly. They usually tell somebody privately and someone else comes out publicly.
Most of them are concerned about their jobs, right?
Yeah.
Well, that happens. We see that happening today.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's happening all the time. It's happening right here where I live. It matters not what job a person's in. He doesn't want to go against the boss.
By the way, you folks down there, down under, you helped find our little 16-year-old sailor girl. Did you hear about that story?
Yeah, what a brave little kid. My.
Would you let your kid go out like that, 16?
I wouldn't want her to go out and do that, no. I'd think I was never going to see that girl again.
No, I'd be more concerned about pirates, not her ability to sail.
Well, yes, pirates. And not necessarily that they'd kill her, but what they could do to her if they kept her alive. Boy, no, I would be very worried about that.
We talked a little bit about Atlantis, Jonathan. Tell me what you think happened there.
Well, Atlantis, there's two ways of looking at Atlantis. Well, firstly, it might be the pre-flood world because there are so many similarities in the story of Atlantis with what we know about the world before the Great Flood. Alternatively, it could be a real city on an island that disappeared under the Atlantic or, as some think, under the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. subsequent to the Great Flood, because for several centuries, several hundred years, there was a settling down process. But let's have a look at this event. The Great Flood was not just a gentle rising of water. It was a cosmic catastrophe. The Earth was suddenly tilted on its axis. There was a huge eruption of the Earth's crust, which brought out fire and water, and continents and seas were churned up together, and for more than a year, huge tidal waves or tsunamis were racing from pole to pole. Everything was totally destroyed. And then, after it was over, as the Earth began to settle down again, there were continual readjustments of stress in the Earth's crust that needed to be rearranged. And this involved huge rises, sudden rises in land, and sudden drops in land. Now, we know that this happened in historical times because we've got up there in South America. I've been on to Lake Titicaca, where they have these lovely little reed boats and floating islands where people live on islands that float around on the lake, made totally of reeds. But just to the south of that lake, about 12 miles further south, is the remains of a city, Tiwanaku. Now, this city was a Pacific seaport when it was built. It still has the seagoing docks for the ships. And it was quite large, actually. You could have several hundred ships tying up at its docks. But it was raised suddenly from sea level to 12,000 feet where it sits today.
What happened?
So if land can rise like that, it can also sink, and that would be another explanation, possibly, of Atlantis.
And but you think that they scurried away in time to go to different regions of this planet?
I'm sorry, would you mind rephrasing that, George?
You say that some of the inhabitants, they were able to go to different regions of the planet.
Yes. Yes, they were. There was early mapping and exploration from the new world that emerged after the great disaster.
I mean, they could have gone to Central America. They could have gone to Egypt. Who knows?
Oh, yes. There would be no problem at all. No problem. We must not think of these people as only having to sail within sight of land. They were smarter than that. They knew what they were doing, and they went out exploring. As a matter of fact, in Australia, we've got remnants of what they left behind when they did explore, from Australia to the Middle East to South America to North America to Europe and Asia. We have the same system of signs and messages left behind by these explorers. They're identical worldwide, showing there was a worldwide exploration, and their inscriptions are being found today.
What,
and then after that, they drew the maps.
What is left for an archaeologist? What is left for an archaeologist to discover now on this planet? What's out there? What could be out there?
What could be out there? Well, certainly we know that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of lost cities that have not been excavated. In the Americas alone, I've heard this on good authority, there could be up to 3,000 unexcavated city locations that are known today but have not been looked into.
Just buried in forests, everything has grown over them?
That's right, yeah.
How big are the cities?
Well, some would be small. Others might be quite large. I can't tell you exactly, but a small town of today would probably be the area of many of them, what we call a small town in America.
And I wonder what kind of technology might be there, if we ever explore.
What might be there? What secrets? Yeah.
Edgar Cayce, ever follow his work?
Yes, I have. I'm not deeply into him, but I do know his work, yeah.
He talked about the Hall of Records, Jonathan, and that they were in three spots. One at the base of the Sphinx, one went down on Atlantis, and the other is somewhere in Central America.
That's quite possible.
And these Hall of Records, he says, will tell you the story, the history of us, and what is going on. And that's another thing I think has been suppressed. I think they found it.
It's quite possible they found the one in Egypt anyway.
Sure.
Mm.
Absolutely. Have you been to Egypt?
Oh, many times. I love Egypt. A land of romance and mystery, George.
When you look at the pyramids, Jonathan, in your mind, what do you say to yourself? How they built it?
They're awesome. Absolutely overwhelming. You just stand there and you look up at this monstrous thing built by the smallest population of Egypt when there were only a few of them there, but so well built, so well constructed.
With high-tech equipment.
Yes, with high-tech equipment. They were not primitives who, as I said, needed huge ramps to build a pyramid. They could move those stones through the air.
Maybe that's what's at the base of the Sphinx. Maybe they put all their tools down in some cave.
Who knows? There's lots of caves under that area. I've been down into one of the underground tunnel systems in Egypt, not there, but in Saqqara, which is a little bit further south. And it's incredible. They're so well made, and the walls are actually tiled, blue ceramic tiles all along the walls.
Well, as a matter of fact, you say that there have been underground tunnels all over the planet, right?
Yes, there are. Mm.
How deep do they go?
That's a hard one. There's one in Ecuador. You go down 200 feet from the entrance before you get to the flat level. It looked like you go down a series of stairs. And then that one turns to the west toward the ocean, goes several hundred miles. And before you get to the end of it, you can actually hear the surf breaking on the ceiling, breaking above the ceiling on the shore. Then you go a little further, and it is blocked by water. So apparently the other end underneath the sea has collapsed.
Well, Jonathan, you've given us a lot of information tonight. We've got one final hour to go with phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. We will be right back. Okay, I'm going to direct you to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the material that Jonathan Gray sent us, because we're going to have him comment on that when we come back, and we'll also take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan, before we go to phone calls here, let's go to some of the material that you sent us. That's up on our coasttocoastam.com website. This one photo here. Tell us about this carved stone in Peru that looks like dinosaurs were on it.
Oh, yes, that's a very interesting one. This actually is one of several thousands that have been found. The man who found them was a farmer. He found them in caves, in graves, and he started telling his friends about them. And the archaeologists came along and said, "Let's have a look." This man handed over some of them, and they had on them some very interesting pictures. Now, these were 2,000 or 3,000 years old. But one of the carvings showed men fighting with dinosaurs. Another one showed men performing operations with surgical equipment, and men with telescopes. And I think the picture that you have there is one showing dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Now, these were drawn by people in the past who knew what these things looked like. And they numbered several thousands. Now, however, eventually, the BBC heard of this discovery, and they did a documentary about these strange stones, and that's what raised the controversy. Pressure was put on government officials, and the villager who had been selling the stones was arrested. Now, how this all happened would do credit to any corrupt politician. The Peruvian government now threatened to prosecute and imprison the farmer, but they offered him a plea bargain. And the frightened man accepted. And then he recanted his story and admitted that he had carved all of the stones himself. 11,000 of them. Uneducated and unskilled as he was, he'd carved out the whole lot. Now, let's understand this. They're very intricately carved with animals and scenes that the farmer could never have knowledge of. And here's a poor man who needed to work hard all day to earn a daily living to support his children and family. Yet despite that, he would have needed to spend every day for several decades and do nothing else to do these 11,000 pictures. The problem was the difficult evidence of human coexistence with dinosaurs and the ancient technological knowledge. How convenient that he admitted he had done them all himself, so no one would ever suspect or discover that these were genuine.
Next up, you've got the skeletons from New Zealand.
Well, in New Zealand over here, there's a lot of controversy over some finds that are being made of a race that was here before the Maoris. The Maoris, of course, are traditionally in the schools being taught as the original inhabitants of New Zealand. But up in the Waipua Forest, just a few hours from where I live, 2,000 ancient structures have been found, and lots of skeletons. Now, skeletons like these are found right across the country, actually. When it was announced that these had been found, a certain New Zealand government department produced an official document which showed an intention to withhold this archaeological information from the public for the next 75 years, and then it could be made available. And neither the general public nor bona fide research workers were allowed to view the results of the digs until the year 2063. It was to be kept top secret for national security reasons. Well, I'm wondering what's national security about ancient remains.
Absolutely. Strange. And what do you think the size is of these skeletons?
The skeletons are rather large, something like 8 or 9 feet.
Giants.
Yeah. But the technology, rather not the technology, the culture that is evident from the diggings shows they have Celtic connections. In other words, there must have been migration or travel or communication between one side of the world and the other way, way back.
And then you've got some kind of a vase or something?
Oh, yes. That is a very interesting one. That's in Israel. It's an ivory pomegranate, actually, from Solomon's Temple. It's been on show for a while in the Israeli Museum as the only artifact from Solomon's Temple. Now, there's been a lot of skullduggery going on about this. In 2004, the item was declared a fake. Then four men were arrested who had something to do with the handing over. It actually was sold originally for $550,000 to the museum. Put on display, it was called a sensational discovery, the only known object from the first temple built by King Solomon in Jerusalem, 1000 BC. And then 2004, it was declared a fake. Four men were put on trial, and it was declared that the inscriptions on it had been put on falsely to increase its value. 3 years later, a scientist by the name of Robert Dusch from Tel Aviv announced that he was going to examine it because he believed that it may not be a forgery after all. Now, leading paleographers from the Hebrew University and from Tel Aviv University were forbidden by the museum authorities to look at it. They were excluded from the group that declared it a forgery. So Robert Dusch kept pushing this, and he said, "I want to check it." They refused him. It was only after his lawyer appealed to the museum's director that he was allowed to visit the museum and examine the pomegranate. But the museum told him that he could not be allowed to use their microscope and not even have a table to put it on, which meant that he couldn't examine it. Eventually, they had their arms twisted and they gave him a table, but they wouldn't give him a chair to sit down on so he could examine it properly. Eventually, he was able to use he'd bought his own microscope because he knew they wouldn't allow him theirs. He spent an hour and a half checking it, and he found that the letters had been engraved and that they dated from the time of King Solomon. That they had been engraved before the ivory was cracked. So the crack was not there first, and the writing was not put on after, so it was not a forgery. Now, I guess we can only speculate on the motives of trying to cover this up, but I can think of three reasons. One is a threat to peace. There are some members of the Jewish government, including some archaeologists, who feel that this discovery would undermine Israel's history in the Holy Land, that if Israel's history could be confirmed, this would enhance the prospects of peace. There's another reason, I believe, that is it's a non-religious anti-Bible bias in the community there. Anything to do with King Solomon is cried down. In fact, there are archaeologists who say King Solomon never existed. Well, we've got enough evidence now that he did. But it's interesting that today what was declared a fake has now been declared genuine, authentic. And the people who could have declared it authentic in the beginning were banned from coming to see it, and others were brought in to declare it a fake. It's interesting.
It sure is. Let's go to get some calls. You ready?
Yep.
We'll go to our first-time caller driving around on the road somewhere in Arkansas. It's James. James, go ahead. You're on.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. I have two things to tell you about. I've been wanting to tell a long time. Is that I know a couple of friends that were in Santa Cruz, California, and they were digging in the basement for a dentist to put an add-on in solid rock, and they were using pickaxes. And they come upon a glass bottle embedded in solid rock, and this is about 8 feet deep. And they were young. They took their time. They got the glass bottle out of the rock and looked at it, and they had hieroglyphics on it, but the top was broken off. They showed it to the owner, and he took it away from them, unfortunately. So that's the end of that story as to whatever happened to that from there. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was I knew an older couple years and years ago that were really good friends of my parents. They were stationed at Roswell Air Base during the 50s and 40s. And they did tell my parents, they swore to them, honest to gosh, that the spaceship crash was real. She was secretary to the commandant at Roswell Air Force Base, and he was in one of the squadrons that flew the B-52s, I believe it was. And just from there, they swore to them that there were dead bodies and there was an actual spaceship crash, but they were told by the government years ago, you know, never to mention anything.
Another cover-up, Ron. Thanks. Did we ever come across any ancient artifacts that look like extraterrestrial craft, Jonathan? Anything out there?
Well, ancient records do state that there were UFO-shaped aircraft manufactured in India, for example. So the shape is something that has been consistent with human history in the past as well. But it's interesting that the historical records of the ancient nations don't say anything about extraterrestrials. They always speak about the human element. But over in South America, there have been found some ancient aircraft, yes, and they are in existence. I have a friend living in Canada, a scientist, who's been into that area. He wants to go back. In fact, he wants me to go with him. And there's an aircraft in the eastern Andes area toward the Brazilian jungle that has been sitting there for the last several thousand years. It definitely was a flying craft.
Okay, let's go now to Ron and Ypsilanti on the wildcard line. Hey, Ron, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Jonathan.
How are you?
Hello. How you doing?
Yeah, pretty good.
Good. He's in Australia. A little lag, but not bad. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay. I was calling about the updates for the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
I get emails from Jonathan all the time, and I wanted to know if he had any updates on that. Also, the caves in the Grand Canyon, I don't know if you talked about those.
No, we haven't gotten into that yet. But what about the Ark of the Covenant, Jonathan?
The Ark of the Covenant, actually, was announced on Israeli television some time back. It had been found under the streets of Jerusalem. But then a clamp was put on the news. The government gave an announcement, testing the waters, and the next day there was a bloodbath. I think 11 people died in a fight between Jews and Arabs. Yes, I do believe that the artifact has been found. It's not in Ethiopia. It's not in Ireland. It's not in Arabia, not over in Jordan. It is under the streets of Jerusalem.
Okay. What about caves? Caves in this country, caves anywhere? Did you study that?
Oh, yeah. Caves. Are we talking about caves in the Grand Canyon?
Yes.
Yes. Way back in the 1800s, a gentleman from the Smithsonian and a team of men discovered a cave high up in the higher reaches of the Grand Canyon. There were mummified remains there. There were hieroglyphics. There were various artifacts. This was reported in the local newspaper at the time he came into town. The Smithsonian sent some people across later. Some of the things were taken away and never seen again. There have been similar reports in more recent years of explorers finding a cave, but the cave is now sealed, and that whole area is under surveillance. It's not open to the public.
All right, next up we go to Bruce in Indiana, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yes, I was wondering if you can make a correlation between the pharaohs of ancient Egypt, pre-Christian ancient Egypt, that had traces of nicotine and cocaine in their bodily tissues, which is indigenous to this hemisphere, not theirs, along with the tomato plants that were tomato seeds that were found in the grave in China.
Yes, that is correct. There's no question about that now. And also, strains of cotton have been found in the Americas that are identical to those in the Middle East.
Hmm. Well, thank you.
All right. Simple enough. Albuquerque, New Mexico, west of the Rockies. Alex, you're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Alex.
Hi. I have kind of a two-part question. It's a little bit complicated, but I'll do my best to be clear.
Sure thing.
Since people could possibly have traveled into space, could they have maybe been able to travel between dimensions or parallel universes? The second part is, if they could travel between dimensions or parallel universes, is it possible that instead of a great disaster, maybe the past humans permanently relocated to one of these other dimensions and became what today we see as aliens?
Well, that's a very interesting theory, and of course, there are a lot of possibilities that we don't know a lot about. We do have written records, and the biblical stories, of course, do tell us that there were a host of rebellious heavenly beings who hijacked this planet. They were cast out, they hijacked this planet, and they started the trouble here, and that they have ability to interact with mankind all the time from one dimension into another. That's written in our history, and also in the history of most of the ancient races. I lean toward that more or less because of the consistent written record. We can, out of our own minds, think up all sorts of other theories, which there's nothing wrong with that. I love theorizing. But as an archaeologist, I have to stick where the facts lead me to go, and that would be the ancient records.
Okay, any follow-up there, Alex?
No, I think that's great. Thank you very much.
Okay, super. What other archaeologists are out there, Jonathan, you know, that support what you do, that are trying to get these answers? Anybody else out there?
Yes, there are some. I don't know of too many, unfortunately, George, but yes, I know there's a couple in Australia. There's another one or two in America. There are several in Europe. But the majority toe the line because they're their salaries depend upon it, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true, too. That's true, too. Are you glad you took this path?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad that I don't depend upon my I don't depend for my income upon somebody who wants me to say what they want to say. By being totally independent financially, and I'm not saying that I'm well off, I'm simply saying that I support myself and my work. And this means I don't have to answer to anybody but the truth.
Well, good for you. Perhaps you'll get the big hit that you've been looking for all your life.
Thank
answers.
You.
What's the one question you would like answered that's never been answered yet?
Oh, you put me on the spot, George. I'm speechless on that one.
You?
To give an honest answer, I'd need to think that one through.
Well, okay, that's fair enough. Your books, Dead Men's Secrets, The Weapons, The Globalist Fear, still available?
Yes, yes. Dead Men's Secrets deals with more than 1,000 examples of lost technology. It's brought it down to about 1,000, just over 1,000 out of many thousands that we could use, but these are the ones that can be confirmed. The Weapon of Globalist Fear speaks of the oldest document in the world, and it happens to be the biblical book of Genesis, and how it and the globalist dreams clash head-on, and who's going to win and why.
Okay, stay with us, Jonathan. We're going to come right back and take final phone calls with you. Where? On Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Jonathan Gray, and your phone calls. Jonathan, by the way, great job tonight. Just superb information.
Oh, it's my pleasure to speak with you, George. I hope everyone else is having a good time.
Everybody is. Back to the phones we go. West Milford in New Jersey, it's Travis's turn. Hey, Travis, go ahead.
Hi, George and John.
Hi.
This has been one of the best shows. The caller from Albuquerque stole a little bit of the thunder I was going to bring to the show. His theory is similar to the one that I just had the idea while listening to everything tonight on the show. Okay, I wanted your opinions on it. It's sort of similar to his, but it has some differences. Maybe we came here from an alternate dimension that overlaps this one, and perhaps whatever Atlantis may have been a way station of sorts, and a disaster may have occurred. Who knows where that could have been? Perhaps we were creating a tangent universe by jumping from dimension to dimension, and they had to either bail or stay, and whoever stayed, I mean, that's what became what we know of as the early civilizations. And also, the pyramid there are chambers in it that there's speculation it's used to channel certain energy, or I don't know if you've heard something like that, but maybe they were trying to get back home. Maybe that's what the pyramids are set up for, these mapping systems. Maybe it's a way in the tunnels in the earth to channel energy and maybe transport the people here back to the other dimension where they came from.
Hmm. What about that theory, Jonathan?
Well, it's an interesting theory. I personally don't go along with it, simply because I believe the ancient records are clearer to the truth than we living thousands of years later are. But let's talk about the pyramid for a moment. Pyramid does have energy. That's very true. In fact, planes are forbidden to fly over the Great Pyramid for that reason.
I didn't know that. I did not know that.
And the pyramid shape itself does accumulate energy. I set up one in my back garden a few years ago when I'm about 10 feet high and put butter in it and put parsley in it and so on. The parsley, by the way, was looking pretty limp in the fridge. Put it into the pyramid for a couple of days and it was spurting up as though it was brand new, growing fresh. So there is energy collected by the pyramid shape, and the ancients used to put pyramids and standing stones at the junctions of natural energy lines under the earth. Like we have water lines, the underground water, we have underground energy. Our earth is like a spinning dynamo. And they used to collect this energy and disperse it around. It was very good for generating electricity, for energizing plants that were growing in the vicinity. So there's certainly energy involved in the pyramid shape, no question about that.
First time caller.
I would not go so far to say that takes us from one dimension into another or helps us get off this planet, but it does have its own right as far as electrical generating power goes.
Let's go to our first time caller, John in Springfield, Illinois. Hi, John. Go ahead.
George, a pleasure and an honor. I've been a Coast to Coast fan since 1995.
Perfect.
And quick question for your guest, and then maybe a statement. I might be able to get some feedback from him. Has he ever heard? I heard on a former show of yours a gentleman that said that a rock had been discovered in New Mexico, and on it the Ten Commandments were written in ancient Hebrew, and it basically was dated pre-Columbus area.
The late Columbus.
I've heard of that. Yes, I believe it was genuine.
Okay, I thought that was true. And a statement I'll share, I'll get off the air and maybe a little feedback. The prophet of the Mormon Church, Brigham Young, stated that Adam and Eve and all life on this planet were brought here from parent stock on other worlds, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Adam and Eve, what do you think of that? You know, the old Anunnaki theory was, of course, they genetically altered us. Do you believe in the Adam and Eve theory?
Oh, I believe in the biblical version of Adam and Eve, which was held by all the ancient races. It's only in modern times we're sort of deviating with our wonderfully fertile imaginations into so many other theories, which are all very interesting.
What is it about Sitchin's theory that you can't, take?
Well, first of all, Sitchin does appeal to the Bible as an authority.
Sure.
Yet the Bible contradicts his theory. How come?
I don't know. Let's go there.
What the book of Genesis does say is that man was created as a deliberate first cause artifact on this planet. He didn't have any other home before he came here. But this planet was specially fashioned. Everything was put in its right position, climate, distance from the sun, the food supply, everything was made just perfect for mankind. And man was put on this planet to reproduce and enjoy it.
What I find
now, the theory that we came from another planet doesn't help us too much, because you've got to account for life on that first planet. You've got to keep on doing that until you come to a first cause. And I believe if we go straight to the first cause already written, that there was a creator and there is a creator, we were created intelligent from the start. It answers all the archaeological mysteries that we have. All the mysteries fall into place.
What I find fascinating, Jonathan, is they talk about a collision that Earth had with another heavenly body based on what he said were the Sumerian texts. And now modern science is talking about Earth collided and, chipped off part of the moon, colliding with another body. Too similar, don't you think?
Well, yes, there are similarities for sure. But, you know, theories come and theories go. They're always changing.
Let's go now to Larry in Canada. Hey, Larry, go ahead.
Hi, John. How are you tonight?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks, Larry.
I'm very good. I just heard what you said, and I appreciate your belief system. I believe the same thing. A couple quick questions. You said early in the show that that aliens or somebody from outer space came and had sex with or procreated with the human race. Now, Genesis 4 talks about the children of God came down and they saw that earthly women were beautiful and had children with them. Is that something like what you were saying? Or?
No. Actually, the book of Genesis, it's interesting. In any old book or any new book, if you want to understand what it's really saying, you must always take the context. Does that make sense?
It does to me.
Put everything in its context. Just don't take one statement and say, it might mean this. Now, if you go back a couple of chapters in Genesis, you'll find that there were two lines of human beings. One remained true to their creator, as they were taught by their original father, Adam. The other became a murderer. He killed his first brother, the line of Cain, and his people who descended from him became robbers and murderers and scoundrels. And they said, we're going the way of man. We're going to become sons and daughters of man. We don't have anything to do with our creator. The other group says, we're going to call ourselves sons and daughters of God. And they remained faithful for a time. But later, as time went on, there was intermarriage between the two groups. And that's what it's talking about. The context of Genesis gives us the understanding. But you can take a thought out of one text and you can make it into anything. And that's how some of these theories do come about.
Let's go next to Stephen in Bentonville, Arkansas, home of Walmart. Hey, Stephen, go ahead.
Yes, Jonathan, I'm very proud that you're doing a very good show tonight.
Sure is, isn't
and
it?
And it's very, very interesting. And all the things that you're saying hold pretty true in my book. My main question tonight is, it's not so much about the caves that are in the United States and around the world in different parts, but mostly the ones that I've been reading about, ones that run basically under the entire United States, and that the aliens use them for flight. They can fly within these tunnels that were created by the military at one point, and also probably by the aliens. So is there a good grounds on that for a belief system that there may be people being held there because of what was signed in 1933 by the president, that they could use people for abduction and research for in exchange for technology?
Very interesting subject, and you're largely on the right track there. I'll just define the word aliens. The people from the other dimension, the rebels who hijacked this planet, if you call those the aliens, I'm 100% with you, because they're interacting with humans and they possess people who are in control of many projects.
Let's go to east of the Rockies, Leon, West Virginia. You're up with us. Hey, Bill.
Yeah, hello, George.
Hi.
I've been listening for a couple months. Love the show.
Great.
And I'm just enthralled by what you all are talking about. I have two questions. The first one, I'm a descendant of Celtic peoples, and I wondered what you know, Mr. Gray, of the ancient Celtic cultures and the technologies they may have had. And the second question is what you know of the Appalachian Mountain region of North America and any of the archaeological finds that exist here.
I'll answer the second question first. I'm not so familiar with specifically the Appalachian Mountain region or anything found there. My research is more on global patterns, and this is where we come back to the Celts. Yes, there certainly was technology among them. We don't know a lot about it, but I can say with a fair amount of certainty that the Celts shared in common with all other cultures the similar type of technology because it was dispersed globally.
Tell me the story about cavemen wearing modern clothes. This is interesting.
Well, we're not told much about this, but it is true that on many of the ancient caves, the caves that we talk about for cavemen, we're told that they were primitive, that they went around with grunts and couldn't speak a language, and they just dragged the women around by the hair and so on. Well, now that's absolutely nonsense. That's as true as the Jolly Green Giant. It's a sacred cow, however, of the popular theory that cavemen were primitive. But do you know, ancient engravings from a cave at Lissac in France show them to be modern-looking people, wearing pants suits, believe it or not, belts, boots, coats, hats, and using handbags. That's the women. And the men with clipped beards and moustaches. Now, how embarrassing for the popular dogma. And I might ask, is that why the public are officially banned from going into that cave? Is this information too dangerous?
It's amazing. Okay, time for a couple more calls, and that's it. Bobby is in Yuba City. First-time caller in California. Hey, Bobby, go ahead.
Hi. This subject is so interesting. I'm amazed. I've never heard anything about it. First of all, I'd like to know where the books can be found, libraries, hopefully, or otherwise. And also, since we're in cycles, what is the cycle that is going to be in front of us now? Not behind us, but in front of us.
What kind of cycles? Jonathan, do you look at that at all?
Yes, I've studied the idea of cycles. I'm not convinced about cycles. I can only be convinced that we have had in the past a destruction. We've also had a high technology. As far as evidence goes back, we can go back one cycle. The rest we can only theorize. But cycles is a fairly modern idea of explaining where we are right now. We are back now to a high technology, so you could call that a cycle. We are facing the possibility of destruction if we don't mend our ways, and that would be a repetition of something. But I have yet to be sold on any evidence that there is anywhere that there were previous events identical. We do know that it has happened before, and it has happened on small scales all over the world, but as for global, I have evidence of only one. And as an archaeologist, I do go for evidence. So if I sound a bit negative about that, it's only because I always insist on evidence. And that's why my work can never be overthrown. I insist on evidence always. When people don't bring out evidence, that's when I get a little bit upset with them. Now, as for where the books can be obtained, beforeus.com is my main website, beforeus.com. And Dead Men's Secrets is available there either as an ebook or as a solid book. There are four ordering options.
And what's your next work? I know you don't stop. Something's coming up.
Well, my next work is probably to go out to the island of Rotuma, north of Fiji. My wife comes from there, and when her grandmother was being buried, they dug up a bone of a 12-foot person. Her mother actually stood with the shin bone up to her waist almost, above her waist.
I've seen some internet pictures. Are they myths? Are they hoaxes? Are they real?
Oh, the ones coming out of Greece at the moment, allegedly out of Greece, are hoaxes, but there are some genuine ones. The hoaxes are being put up by technology on the internet simply to discredit the genuine ones, because there are people who don't want the genuine to get out. So there's plenty of hoaxes going around.
Okay, and I want to thank you, Jonathan, for being on the program. Just a remarkable work. And do you think one day the public will become so aware of this, not from programs like this, not from people like you, but from actual other researchers who say, we found this and we want you to know about it? Will they ever come forward?
I hope so. And I believe that some will come forward. There will always be independent researchers who will confirm the truth.
I hope so, too. At what cost for them?
Sometimes at the cost of their lives, but brave men, there are plenty of them are still around. They just have to stand up and be counted.
What time is it for you now, down under?
The time now is almost 9 in the evening.
9 in the evening. Well, it's 2 a.m. in the morning here on the west coast of the United States.
Well, I'm coming out tomorrow for you, George, because it's 9 o'clock Friday evening.
You're time traveling.
That's right.
Tell me what happened Friday evening, and I can, well, I guess we can't do that, can we? Jonathan, thanks for being on the program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.